Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, Chris Sullivan, now joined by Felix Bonnell on the days may be numbered for Memorial Stadium. Formerly known as Seattle High School Memorial Stadium at Seattle Center, built in 1947 in honor of the Seattle Public School alums who died in World War II. Late yesterday, the city and the school district announced a search for a private partner to help build what they describe as a new multi-purpose sports, educational, and entertainment venue where the old stadium currently stands. And to give us the update and to air his concerns is our resident historian, Felix Bonnell. Hi, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we've been covering this story. I've been covering the story for Cairo for about 6 years. I went back and looked at some of the old stories yesterday. And number one, I'm really glad they're finally doing something. I don't know if you've looked at that stadium lately, but the outward appearance of it, it's just disgraceful. Because the front there are 800 names of kids who died in World War II who were Seattle School alums. But I do have some concerns about it because there's been a pattern of them being slow to share information relevant, to the parts of the story that doesn't really get reported very often. First of all, is the actual condition of the stadium structure, which is still in use all the time, right? Como did a story yesterday. Chris Daniels quoted Fred Podesta. He's the operations officer for the district. He said, the stadium has reached the end of its useful life. And a year or so ago, I asked for documentation about that, and they gave me a study that an architect had done that said there's some concrete damage here and there. Nowhere, I can't see anything that would lead someone to make the conclusion it's reached the end of its useful life. It's used every day.
Right, but it's out of date. I mean, it's got supports that block the view.
Yeah, but that hasn't reached the end of its useful life. There's semantics in this. I realize there's semantics in this, and I'm not one of these people who wants to save every single old thing. But this has like some special connections to it for the reasons it was built and who it was built for. It's not just an old school that's sitting in some neighborhood of Seattle that's unused. Second thing I'm concerned with, the naming rights, because as part of the package, whoever, there's a private investor will be attracted to this and they'll be able to sell the naming rights to anyone they want. Memorial has to be in the name. That's all that's required.
Right.
And I asked about this. There was a press conference 5 years ago when then-Mayor Tim Burgess, he was mayor for about 25 minutes in November of 2017 when we went through a succession of mayors. And at the end of this press conference announcing the partnership between the city and the school district, I raised my hand and said, well, are naming rights going to be considered? And everyone laughed. Literally, you could hear people in the audience chuckling. And I think Tim Burgess chuckles too. Here's what he said back then.
That'll all be dealt with later as the public planning process unfolds.
Yeah.
To me, that's a real concern.
Well, they're keeping the memorial, right? They're obviously going to do that, they did with the new police station.
We'll get to the semantics of that, because what actually constitutes the memorial? That's my bigger question, right? Okay, so there is whoever bids on this gets the right to sell the naming rights, as long as they retain memorial. Nowhere in the RFP is the actual official name, Seattle High School Memorial Stadium. That's not even mentioned in this 41-page document. They just keep calling it Memorial Stadium. And I remember, you know, there's 800 names there. They're all, and I read them once on a Facebook Live thing. It took me like 35 minutes. My friend Ken, we stood there with little cameras and recited all the names. And those names are they're not in the picture, really. It's not really part of the discussion. That's concerning to me because, again, the whole reason the thing is there is it's a memorial. When they dedicated in 1947, I think it was November of 47, they said, you know, these kids are playing on the field that their alums don't get to play on, and the facility is dedicated to the memory of these 800 people. That wall of names didn't come along until 4 years later. This in the 20th century, the memorial was the thing you used. It wasn't just a plaque. Mm-hmm. The whole facility is a memorial. And I get it. I'm in the minority in thinking that, I believe. But there's sort of this presumptuousness about the landmark status, too, also in this RFP and in all the district materials. There's no mention of that fact that the stadium came first and the wall came later. There's no mention of the 800 names or who they are. It just says, you know, there's the memorial wall this and memorial wall that. And here's what it says about the landmark status, because any project like this will have to be reviewed by the Seattle Landmarks Board, right? And it says, here's the quote. Proposers should develop their proposal with this assumption that Memorial Stadium will not be designated as a landmark, but must provide for restoration and maintenance of the memorial wall. So they're just assuming that the stadium, which is almost 80 years old, built by an architect named Stoddard, who also built or designed Husky Stadium, Aqua Theater, Green Lake Park, a significant architect, they're just assuming that, oh, it's not going to be a landmark. Don't worry about that part. And that concerns me. It's like they're trying to skip over that and kind of gloss over what we're actually dealing with here.
Well, I think they're saying that for it to be a viable deal, you can't use the existing structure. You got to save the memorial. But the stadium itself, with the supports that actually land in some of the seats, right, would not make a viable sports venue in this day and age.
But those concerns about the actual status of the memorial and the stadium as a landmark, those haven't been vetted. Even I reached out to the state architectural historian. He's the guy who oversees.
Well, do you think they're really going to basically say we're going to forget these names? I can't imagine Seattle doing that.
Yeah, and that's where I realize that I'm in the minority here about seeing this as the stadium itself is the memorial. Right.
I know.
And if it's not going to collapse, right? It's still standing. It survived the 49 earthquake, the 65 quake, the 01 quake. Why not at least? Not give lip service, but I don't think they know what it would cost to actually renovate that.
Well, you just want to give it like a paint job and just call it good?
No. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do in the 21st century to take a 1947 building and make it last another 100 years. I mean, again, I'm not... Do I sound like a lunatic talking about this, Dave? You can be honest with me. Do I sound crazy?
You don't sound like a lunatic, but that is an incredibly valuable piece of property, right? I mean, it is, and I think it's underutilized. I think there are a lot of events that could be going on there that don't, because it doesn't have the facilities that people expect. They'll like the old Key Arena. I mean, I thought it was perfectly fine, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out to be a viable and profit-making venue. You had to do all that rebuilding. You had to dig down another story, for crying out loud. And now the thing is a tremendous success. We got a hockey team.
I mean,
Memorial Stadium, the names have to be honored. They're sacred. But they're standing outside what's now considered a pretty shabby building.
It's demolition by neglect. It's only a shabby building because it's been neglected by the owner, the Seattle Public School District, for at least 30 years.
See, that's in the past, though. wishing will not make it so, as we learn from Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I guess if I was related to one of those kids on the wall, the 100 kids, and the building that was built in their honor and dedicated in November 1947 to their memory.
Yeah.
That building's going to be torn down. That seems insulting to me, because the building was let's build this building and let's have kids play sports here because we won World War II and those kids gave up their lives. They made the ultimate sacrifice. We won. Here we are. Let's not just have a plaque that's going to come along 4 years later. Let's have a thing we use all the time that actually is a memorial, and that if it was taken care of, it could be restored. It could be renovated. Mm-hmm. But again, maybe I sound like a lunatic.
Well, don't we have other high school stadiums now, though, don't we?
What do you mean?
Around the district? Is that the only high school stadium there is?
Oh, no.
We've got the big one at West Seattle.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really wanted to keep it to its original purpose, you could move the memorial to a stadium that's being used by high school kids.
You know, it's not about the purpose. It's about the facility itself is the memorial versus just the wall. That's the only thing. That's maybe it's splitting hairs, but just sort mm-hmm. of... And the documents the district provided, they don't really – let's just be honest about what we're doing. Let's say that we're going to tear down the building that was built to the kids. Let's just be honest about it. Let's not try and steamroll it through. Let's say what we're really doing and then let people decide.
Okay. But I think it would be unfair to say that because they want to replace the stadium, it means they no longer honor the memory of those who died.
I get you. I don't want to change your mind. No, I understand. All right. Thank you for listening.
Felix Bonnell, all of his features at MyNorthwest.com. Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. A 100-mile detour is what drivers will face this summer if their plans take them across the Hood Canal Bridge. Chris, what's up?
Yeah, 100 miles.
That's crazy.
And
is that why they built the bridge in the first place?
What's that? Yeah, really, pretty much. Right. Yeah, to get you a way to get across there. Because the Hood Canal Bridge is going to be closed for 4 full weekends this summer, sometime between July and September. That leaves a ferry, just the little one, to get down to Port Townsend from Coopville, which can't handle a lot, or that 100-plus-mile detour that takes you all the way down Highway 3 to Shelton and then back up 101 all on the other side of the Sound. I mean, that's the reality here. The Washington Department of Transportation's Mark Krulish says they need to replace a key bridge component.
What we're doing is we are repairing the center lock mechanism on the bridge, and that is basically the mechanism that holds the bridge together.
So kind of an important piece of the bridge there. Now, this work was supposed to happen in 2021, but it was postponed because of the pandemic. It was rescheduled for last year, but supply chain issues got it in the way, and so now we are pushed to 2023. Krulish says this is something that cannot be done in bad weather.
We're going to be in the water. We're going to be suspended from a bridge, so the water absolutely absolutely has to be calm in order to do this, and the time to do that is in the summer.
So already asking the questions as to why you couldn't have done this some other time other than the busiest travel and tourist season. States trying to finalize which weekends it will perform the work, fully recognizing that this will create huge problems.
We know every weekend on the Olympic Peninsula there is a huge event that draws tons of people out there. But what we're looking at most is, when's the weather the best? When are the tides going to be calm? When are the winds going to be calm so we can get this work done?
Crewley says the contractor is looking to see if it can find some windows here and there during those weekend closures to allow some bridge access. We should get a better idea on the scheduling in early April, and I'm sure it'll probably change a lot with the weather, the tides, the things they're looking at. But this is something that you really need to start looking at now if you have summer weekend plans on the peninsula.
Even though we know how impactful these closures are, it would be even more impactful if the system were to fail, because this is the mechanism that holds the bridge together, and it needs repairs. It's incredibly important work.
Of course, there are also some smaller construction projects planned on Highway 3 and 101, which is the primary detour route that cannot be delayed or postponed either. So, 100 miles plus a little bit more with your time. There are also no plans for any additional ferry service to help get around. And as I mentioned, the only run that would help would be Coupeville Port Townsend, which can't handle much more than it already does. More than 18,000 people use that bridge every day on summer weekends. It can be way more than that. These weekend closures are going to have a huge impact, even so much as the people who live along 3 and 101 who can't get out of their driveway because the road is backed up that much. So we need to start planning for this thing now. As I said, sometime in July and September, 4 full weekend closures.
Are there any other floating bridges that are in tidal areas like this one is?
In our state?
Anywhere.
I'm not sure. There must be, because we're not the only place that has a coastline or something. But again, we're in a weird situation because that's so far inland from the coast that that other bridges may not. But I can look that up. But yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, again, tides, the whole deal. I mean, that's not a floating bridge, but yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, it is a floating bridge though, right? The Senescal.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of the other ones just offhand that aren't floating. Obviously, across the Duwamish, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm talking about.
But not a floating bridge. Yeah,
I'm amazed it exists at all.
Considering the weather they get there during the winter, are you kidding me? Yeah.
that plus having to deal with tidal action every single day. I mean, so I guess what I'm saying is, I can understand why they'd want to be especially careful about getting this project right.
Right, exactly. And again, the work is going to be so dangerous that they basically need a flat water surface there in order to do that, or else it would just be way too dangerous to do it.
Right. Plus, it sunk once before, so we don't want that to happen again. Not to bring back bad memories.
How many of our floating bridges have had some sinking issues?
Yes, we've had two.
Two, yeah.
Yeah, and then one suspension bridge that had a wind issue.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Wow. What's our track record? Looking back, Dave, our track record is not all that good.
Plus the low-level West Seattle Bridge, remember, you get hit by the ship. You never like it when the ship hits the span, as we say.
That is so true.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, and now Matt Markovich, who's covering Olympia for us this session. We have a new state revenue forecast out. We have the update on the governor's housing plan, which may be in trouble. So, Matt, what's up first here?
Well, all about money and taxes. We all, what is it they say? There's something
nothing more
your life than death and taxes.
Death and taxes, right.
Yeah, we've got taxes. And so what happened yesterday is that the state released its tax forecast. And while it's good for the first, the next 2 years, it's not so good for the following 5 or 6 years after that. Actually, it's still pretty good, but it's less than what the Democrats and the Republicans were expecting. Now, Steve Lurch is actually the state's revenue forecaster, and here's how he basically set the tone for the table.
We have seen the Washington economy doing a bit better than the U.S. We've seen employment growing a bit stronger. So we see Washington population growing faster than the U.S. The pandemic slowed down a lot of migration, but we do anticipate Washington is going to grow faster than the U.S. And so that's going to be certainly a positive for employment growth.
So it's all good news, but it's less than what the lawmakers had wanted. So the forecast for the current biennium, which is a 21-23, what we just had, was $194 million. That was more than what we expected. But going forward, like the next biennium, the next 2 years, it's going to be $483 million less than what they projected just in November. It's still $1.6 billion more than what they're going to have right now. So what does this mean going forward for the budget writers who are currently writing the budget and about to release it this week? Democratic Senator Christine Rolfes is one of the chief budget writers for the Senate.
We haven't been building a budget based on 13% and 15% historic growth rates. So this news makes us cautious, but it doesn't really change our game plan that much. So I think we're in okay shape.
So that's on the Democratic side. Obviously, the Republicans have a certain opinion. Republican Senator Linda Wilson is a ranking minority member and the budget writer in the Senate.
It is clear that we don't need to raise taxes or create new taxes, and I'm really heartened by that. It would be a very good idea to take a more cautious approach to spending in the upcoming operating budget. Spending has more than doubled in the past 10 years, and that the rate of growth simply can't continue if we want to remain in a sound budget position.
So the two parties agree, no new taxes?
Well, the Democrats are proposing several new taxes. Oh. That was the Republican who's saying that, no new taxes. You know, the Democrats are proposing a wealth tax. There's the capital gains tax, which is going to in the courts right now.
I thought
now.
I heard Senator Rolfes say that there wasn't much change, and so they felt they were in good shape. But they're still proposing new taxes?
Oh, yeah. The Democrats are, yes, yes. But, you know, they want to have more money. It's a tremendous amount of money. It's a good, actually, you know, the big picture here, Dave, is that the state of Washington is doing really well. It's seeing continued growth. It's just not as growing as fast, so now they're going to cut back on their budgets because they're anticipating less money than they predicted. They're still making more money every year. That's not the issue. But what was an issue yesterday was the governor's housing proposal. We've been talking about this $4 billion housing plan that he's been proposing, a levy that would go to the voters in November if approved. Well, the Senate released its capital budget, and it did not include his money that he wanted. The plan for $4 billion, it basically included just $625 million that would go toward housing. And it kind of reflects, we kind of heard about this a little bit from the House side back in February 28th when the Speaker of the House told us, and the governor responded to this comment that day, that the plan, his plan may not be the most preferable plan that the legislature is looking at.
I don't know that it's is rising as a preferred strategy. And so at a certain point, we're going to have to decide, is there another idea that we think is more fiscally sound, or it provides more opportunity, or whatever the, you know, critiques may be? Is there another option, or is this really the option?
Huh. So the governor responded yesterday saying in a statement that this would take us backwards in housing. It's going to be less than what was approved in the last biennium, and that we're in the middle of a housing crisis and it's less acceptable and we need to go big so people can go home. That's been his phrase. So it's not looking good for that $4 billion. Again, the House has not released its idea about what to do on a capital budget, but that's not looking too good right now. If the senators, Democratic senators, are not including it in their capital plan.
Yeah, right. All right, what about this school recess issue?
Yeah, how about that? It's become one of the more controversial issues, believe it or not, in this legislative session. Should basically elementary school students get a minimum of 30 minutes of recess every day on a normal school day? So what happened yesterday is somewhat of a tight vote. It was on the floor of the House. Democratic Representative April Berg acknowledged that there were some concerns about the state taking over the idea about recess and not giving it back to the local school district.
There are concerns from some of my former colleagues, school board directors, who are very much focused on local control of the school districts as well as the school day. And I do believe that this bill addresses their concerns.
So the school is going to impose a recess mandate of some kind?
Well, you know, though they want to have control over how they're going to do recess. Every individual school district does have that control right now. But there's been complaints that kids aren't getting recess, like just like they're not getting enough time for lunch. So they felt that it's necessary to put a rule in effect ordering schools to have at least a minimum of 30 days. But here's the highly debated issue: was using recess or exercise as punishment. There was an amendment yesterday that would remove a language in a model policy that the school districts are following that basically allow teachers and coaches to use exercise as a discipline. It's that whole thing, drop and give me 20 or you're going to run 50 laps. You know, is that good or bad? Now, Democratic Representative Sharon Tomiko Santos says there's a racial component to this.
Too often across our state, we find that exercise or the assignment of physical activity is disproportionately affecting students of color.
Now, she did not present any evidence of that effect. I was kind of, I looked around for some evidence of that, but I couldn't immediately find anything of that. Now, Republican Senator Jim Walsh has another take.
To a high-spirited, rambunctious kid, exercise is one of the healthiest tools for learning discipline and learning focus. And while you're running those laps, Mr. Speaker, I guarantee you, you think about what you said or what you did that wasn't right.
Yeah, so, all right. So which way are the winds blowing? What's the legislature going to decide when it comes to recess and exercise? I can't believe I'm saying this. Go ahead.
So they did not approve the idea of using exercise or recess as discipline. So you can't use it as a disciplinary measure. But they went ahead and approved that you can have a minimum of 30 minutes of recess on an every day. It has, and that was a big issue too. School days change in size. You know, summer days are shorter. When it's a shorter day, you don't have to have 30 minutes of recess. But, you know, believe it or not, this is, you know, as I've been looking at all the votes and all the issues I've been going through there, this is one of the more contentious ones. Yeah. It passed substantially in the House, and now it goes back to the Senate because they have a change. But it's getting closer to the governor's desk. But believe it or not, it's one of those issues that was like easy to understand. A lot of people had opinions on it. And, you know, the coaches, does this really rule out coaches saying drop and give me 20 or take 50 laps as discipline? The law, the current language says the school districts are encouraged not to do that. The word is encouraged not to do that, but coaches
there's
still can.
Still some flexibility. All right. Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird. The world needs more crunch. That's the motto for an Annapolis business owner, Marcus Moore. He has a passion for pretzels and tells NBC affiliate WBAL-TV his pretzel business, Moore Crunch, is booming and inspiring people with autism and other disabilities in the process.
I just enjoy doing this. Seriously, I really do. I love it.
Finding something he loves means a lot to him. He's 29 years old, and he has autism. Although he's worked at a local grocery store over the years, he's always wanted to grow and be self-sufficient.
I know some jobs may not offer those that, you know, for a supervisor position or manager position, because maybe autism, like, I may lack some, like, that big leadership skill.
He came home one day from work, and he was kind of upset. He wanted to know if what he makes for a living is enough so he can take care of himself. On his own as an adult. His mother and I were sitting around one day. We were like, okay, what can we do?
His parents thought about how much Moore loves snacks and suggested he start his own pretzel business. He bought in and started testing out flavors in the kitchen right away.
Cinnamon sugar, Maryland crab, garlic ranch, buffalo, and the smokehouse ranch.
Since the start of Moore Crunch in October of last year, he sold more than 600 bags of pretzels, each hand-packed and labeled with love by Moore himself. And with several stores carrying his product, business is booming.
The online orders have been shoo. Come in.
Just to see how people have embraced him, you know, the social life that he never had, you know, the opportunities that he didn't really have growing up, you know, they're coming to him now.
And with his newfound success, Moore is thinking about the next steps, like finding a commercial kitchen, hiring other people with autism or other disabilities to help him out.
It's great to see, like, being an inspiration to those out there that you can do anything.
He was a joy to listen to his story. You can find out more on supporting his business at more M-O-O-R-E, crunch.com.
7:48, and now from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Here is G. Scott, and you tweeted out a personal story over the weekend, which I wanted you to share with us because it explains why you want to stick up for people.
Right, and I don't know why I told the story. The interesting part is before the other day, I had never shared that story in my entire life. Mm. Story dates back to when I was in seventh grade in military school, and there was this really big kid. And now, granted, in seventh grade, I was a big kid, but this kid was a little older, and he was built like an Adonis. I'm being serious. I'm talking huge. And whenever I just saw him, only thing I could think about is, if I do something that he doesn't like, he will destroy me. I used to think that. Anyways, one night I woke up with a Charlie horse in the middle of the night, something as a kid for some reason I used to do all the time.
Oh, sure.
So I woke up in the middle of the night. I remember exactly what time it was. It was 3:13. And the reason why I remember it, because of what happens next. I hear, stop, stop. And I hear it's like some tussling. And then I hear kind of a be quiet type of deal. And so I automatically knew who that be quiet was from.
Now you're at a boarding school at this point, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm in a barracks at a boarding school, a military school. I knew where that voice came. I know that voice. And I'm thinking, oh, man, he's beating him up. And I was just scared, powerless, did not move, stayed in bed. So a couple days later, the big kid gets kicked out of school. Come to find out, he didn't just beat him up. He sexually assaulted that little boy. And I was thinking, and by the way, no adults ever ask questions or, you know, mm-hmm. this is 1988. No adults ask questions. Nobody asks what happened. And all the friends are talking like, man, you heard about what happened and all this stuff. And I always kept it that I actually heard. I didn't know it was sexual assault at the time, but I actually heard when it happened. And it was after that, it always stuck with me. And sometimes we stick up for others even when it is at the cost of ourselves or even when you know that it might not turn out well for you.
Right.
Now, I don't feel bad that I didn't do. I mean, I was a kid, right? I didn't know what really to do. I was powerless as a kid. But as an adult, my point and the reason why I posted it is, well, number one, it felt good to tell that story. I don't know why. It's weird.
Get it off your shoulders.
It really felt good to tell it.
It's a point of shame because you feel like you should have stood up. You should have helped even though you were a kid and you acknowledge, you know, it's a yes and thing. Yes, I was a kid and I feel I could have done more.
Right.
So by telling that story, you're releasing that shame.
Yeah. So you're right, Colleen. That's exactly what happened, mm-hmm. how I felt after I told it. And then second, it was like... It's truly like I know that, and I know I'm not the only one, that there's just moments where you don't help someone else out because you're worried about yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And even though you know, like, hey, you stepping up and doing something is the right thing, you sometimes remain silent and nobody's going to say anything to you because nobody knows that you know. Only you know mm-hmm. that you know. Mm-hmm. And only you know if and when you did not act.
And I noticed you posted around the same time the NHL controversy was going on with the one player saying, like, I won't wear the pride shirt because I read the Bible. And, you know, I feel like maybe that is tied to that, where it's like the point isn't to protect yourself and these beliefs. The point is, by wearing that shirt, you invite a diverse group into this sport and make them feel welcome, including some of your teammates who might also be gay.
Very well done, Colleen.
Oh, yes. I follow your tweets, G. I see the through.
Yeah,
I see the through
that's
line.
That's exactly when I posted it. And, you know, when I, in defense of the LGBTQ community, people think one of two things about me. They think, A, well, G, are you gay? No. Or B, gee, are you a non-believer? No, I am a believer. Both can be true.
Mm-hmm. Both should be true.
Both should be true, right? And you can still stand up for other people that aren't like you. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is that I believe that all of us, I'm talking about get away from opinion, because sexuality is not an opinion, right? All of us should be able to exist in this world and not be considered, oh, you're one of them. Because at one point, I wouldn't be able to be on this radio station because the color of my skin made me, oh, you're one of them, mm-hmm. right? So if we have grown past that, I'm just looking forward to the day that we grow past this. I thought we was there. We got a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, it takes allies like you. So thank you, G, for sharing.
This is how deep things get on the June Ursula Show.
Absolutely.
It starts at 9 on Cairo News Radio. This is Seattle's Morning News, and joining us from the New York Times, as he does every Tuesday, is David Farenthold. David, we're on the indictment watch, wondering whether Trump's going to be indicted and arrested today. I hear that there have been barricades going up in around the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Have you seen those?
I have not seen them. I think they are up there and in New York, and where there are people who are worried about violence toward the district attorney.
Right. So, well, nobody really knows, I guess, but what's your bet here? Do you think this is when the hammer finally drops?
I don't know, actually. I think that probably they want to keep us guessing, and they won't tell Trump until right before, given what he's done already in terms of, you know, when he had some sort of inkling of when this was going to be trying to bring a protest down. I think when it does happen, it'll happen early in the morning. I don't think it'll happen, you know, and I think we will wake up to find out, especially you guys in the West Coast will wake up to find out that it happened.
Yeah.
Doing it in the middle of the day seems crazy. My one experience was this was staking out the district attorney's office in 2021, waiting for Alan Weisselberg, Trump's CFO, to be arrested. And that all happened quite early in the morning.
So what about his call to action? How is that going down with other Republicans?
Well, it seems like other Republicans have picked up part of what Trump said. They have picked up the criticism of Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA is politically motivated. This is just a witch hunt. And I think it has given Trump a lever to make other Republicans, even like Ron DeSantis, his potential rival in the 2024 campaign, to make them sort of defend him and step up for him. That said, even the most extreme elected officials, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene in the House, have not picked up the call for violence. Nobody has said, or even for protests. Everybody that's been asked about this has said, look, there's no need for protests. There's no need for violence. You know, we will raise questions in the House and hold hearings, but there's not going to be any need to protest.
Okay, well, let's look at this then from Trump's point of view for a moment. These charges are not new. They go back a long time. And other jurisdictions have had a chance to prosecute on this and have passed, right?
The main group, the only group that has prosecuted on this so far has been the U.S. Attorney's Office, the federal prosecutors, who, as you recall, arrested, charged, and convicted Michael Cohen, Trump's fixer, for his role in this. And Trump, Cohen at the time said, you know, Individual One, if you remember that name, Individual One, Trump, had told him to do everything that he did. And so federal prosecutors didn't prosecute Trump at the time, maybe because they thought the evidence was not as strong, maybe because they were guided by the long-term guidance that says you can't charge a sitting president, maybe because they felt like they couldn't charge, you know, the witness here was Cohen to be used against Trump, and maybe they felt like they couldn't convict Cohen and then immediately use him as evidence against Trump. The Manhattan DA seems to have a different opinion. They've been talking to Cohen quite a lot. And there are different laws here in terms of state versus federal, so they may think they have a stronger case.
So is that because more evidence has been developed, or is it just because there's a new DA in town?
I don't think that there has really been any new evidence developed. I mean, I think the evidence was pretty clear back then. There's a paper trail, Trump signing checks.
Yeah.
You know, Cohen has said that he believes Trump understood it was happening, directed it to happen. I think the charge they're going to make against Trump here is something like falsifying business records, not the payoff exactly, but to falsify the records, internal records of the Trump organization to cover up the fact that they had reimbursed Cohen for the payoff. I think there are a little bit better state laws than federal laws there.
But this is just one person. If we're going to talk about falsifying records, wasn't there a bigger case involving these real estate deals? What's the status of that?
That has become a civil case. The Trump org has been sued by the New York Attorney General for a variety of accusations that he manipulated real estate valuations to get better deals on taxes and things like that. That had been the focus of the Manhattan DA's investigation under the old DA, Cyrus Vance, who left office at the end of last year. So the question was, would the new DA, Alvin Bragg, be more aggressive? Would he pick that case up? He seems to have rejected the idea that you could make that into a criminal case. We have not heard much about that at all, and instead has picked up, you know, this long simmering question about the payoffs to Stormy Daniels. So I don't expect we'll see criminal charges related to the real estate deals, even if we see charges related to Stormy Daniels.
So if the real estate deals, which I think it would involve a lot more money than this, if that's not a criminal case, what makes this a criminal case?
I think this is about New York law. New York law is actually not very good on prosecuting valuations. That's those sorts of crimes. There's not really a bank fraud statute in New York. That's what it would be, defrauding a bank. New York, for whatever reason, maybe that the feds are so big on prosecuting bank fraud, doesn't really have a strong bank fraud statute. I think the thing that Trump is doing, the thing that Trump's being charged with doing in this Stormy Daniels case, the law is just stronger in New York for whatever historical reason.
Okay. On a completely different story, I remember vividly when the Iranian hostages were released back in, what was it, 1980. Actually, it was 1981, right after the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. I mean, it clearly was timed. And there was a piece in the New York Times that relied on a source who was, I guess he was a diplomat at the time. We were all wondering, did Ronald Reagan or his supporters have any role in delaying the release of the hostages to basically tank Jimmy Carter's presidency? And now here comes forward, this guy comes forward in the New York Times saying, yeah, we sent people around to various Middle Eastern capitals to urge these leaders to get in touch with the clerics in Iran and make darn sure that those 444 hostages were held there until the inauguration. You saw that story. What do you think about that?
I did. That was an incredible story. A name source, somebody who'd been close to the people around Reagan, who said, you know, I don't think he delivered the messages, but he went around with the people who did deliver the messages to the Iranians through those other Middle Eastern leaders. It seems like the strongest evidence we've ever seen that Reagan's team, presumably with Reagan's blessing, was going around, as you said, telling the Iranians, keep the hostages. And you remember the conditions those hostages were being held under, the strain on their families.
Yeah.
You know, they said, keep them, what turned out to be, you know, hundreds of days longer, basically because we can give you a better deal. And Reagan will give you a better deal. And it does seem like that worked. As you said, it helped, you know, both the crisis and also Carter's response to the crisis, where he didn't campaign, were a huge factors in Carter's defeat. And you're right, this seems to confirm a suspicion people had forever. But it does it now at a time when Reagan obviously is dead. Almost everyone around Reagan is dead. Carter is in hospice care. You know, the people, the principals involved are almost all gone.
Yeah. Well, that's why he waited. I get that. But I mean, talk about I wasn't sure from the article. Was he saying that Reagan did know, or that we're just assuming he knew?
I think it was the latter. He assumed from the, you know, the way people around Reagan talked, and you know, the conversations, the frequency with which they were talking to Reagan himself, that Reagan knew and directed it. But I don't think he ever heard Reagan say, do this.
Well, because you want to talk about a high crime?
Yeah, right.
That would qualify, don't you think?
And our story said things like, you know, Carter was always, you know, even when the hostages were returned, when Carter met returned hostages after he was president, they were always so hostile toward him because they believed he had somehow caused them to be, you know, held there longer. And it seems like the very opposite is true.
David Farenthold from The New York Times. David, thank you.
Thank you.
8:47. Now it's time for the Gomez Report with Mickey Gomez. And look at this. The latest survey by the Downtown Seattle Association shows that the number of people living in downtown, we're not talking about commuters now who commute and go home, but who are living full-time in downtown Seattle is now 104,000 people. which apparently is a record for downtown.
It really is. Downtown Seattle Association 2023 economic report confirms this, saying that all 12 downtown Seattle neighborhoods from Soto to South Lake Union to Capitol Hill is now home to more than 14% of all Seattleites. And so the reason that this matters is because our city's been hit hard by the pandemic and it's recovering at a snail's pace, unlike, you know, other cities like San Francisco, which have reportedly bounced back nicely. But this is really good news.
The DSA actually posted a number of the new projects going in downtown, the biggest one being the convention center, which I haven't seen one yet. I'm going to go to a banquet there in a couple of weeks, so I'll get to see the inside. But I thought that was a pretty spectacular addition. I'm just worried whether they're going to be able to fill it. Apparently, though, they had some pretty healthy tourism. Last year, 3 million visitors downtown.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a lot to me.
Is that mostly cruises, though? So yeah. Part of it is cruises. A lot of people are coming here. They go to the ports. Then they go to Alaska. But they spend their dollars here. And then a lot of people are just, you know, They're moving here. We're transplants here. Matter of fact, we live in Capitol Hill. I was a little worried because we had to tell the owners of the house that we live in Capitol Hill, hey, we're leaving and, we're moving. I hope you can rent the place, because I was a little worried. Mm-hmm. And then they emailed us and said, we'd like to host an open house, a private open house, if you will, a viewing.
Oh, they'll have a wait list.
Oh, no, it's already happened. Yeah. We staged the house. And we left for an hour and came back, and they were telling us, listen, we think the house is already rented. People were already negotiating the rent, saying, hey, can we take it now? We'll put down money now that we want it. We'll take it.
So it seems like the living situation in downtown is great. It's the businesses that haven't quite recovered.
Exactly. And just because the residents are back doesn't mean that businesses are rushing to move back downtown. Some businesses are still shy to return because of what's happening with big companies like, say, Amazon, with the recent layoffs and then the big announcement of more layoffs happening yesterday. But we do know that some businesses are staying. I know that our favorite movie theater, because we do go to the cinema downtown when our kids want to go to the movies, we go to either AMC or we go to Regal. And we were devastated when we found that Regal was going to be shutting down. That's like,
well, in Pacific Place, that's where AMC is, right? That's like a ghost mall.
And then we go, it is a ghost mall. It's crazy. I'm surprised it's still open, but we go there and, we park there. We go to the movies there. We go to Johnny Rockets. We eat dinner there. Yeah. Like, we really try and have the overall Seattleite experience and spend our money locally, even though I know Johnny Rockets and AMC are national chains, but they're still here.
Yeah, and it's easy for families too. I'm kind of curious because I've lived here my whole life, born and raised, and I spent about 5 years in Missouri, but that's too young to remember. So this is all I've known is Seattle. I think moving to Spokane was my first indication of like, oh, I'm not in Kansas anymore. You know, it's different over there. So I don't really have a scope of like why people want to move here. What was attractive to you as somebody who has lived in Detroit, New York, and Texas? Like, why is Seattle the place people talk about going to?
I felt like we were safer here, especially when my child, we just felt the laws were safer, especially when it comes to women, when it comes to women's rights, when it comes to people of color, when it comes to LGBTQ families, when it just came to being able to have the luxuries that we have here versus somewhere else like Texas and the laws that they're trying to pass, the anti, LGBT laws, the anti, the gun carrying laws, things like that, making it, wanting to track girls' periods, things that we were like, you know what, we're out of here.
Do they really want to track girls' periods?
Yes, they do want to track girls' periods. Wow. Yes, they do.
The only place I knew that did it was China. Communist China. Wow.
No, and the interesting thing, and what really pushed us over the line, was when the governor tried to pass the anti-trans bill for trans youth, saying that trans youth can't play sports. And my daughter's an athlete. And although she's not trans, she identifies, she's a girl, she's she, her, but she looks masculine, and she plays girls' sports. And if we were in Texas right now, she wouldn't be able to play.
They would have questioned that.
They would have questioned. Jeez. They would have wanted to do a physical. They would have wanted to see her birth certificate.
And her period and all of that.
This is a small government state, huh?
So at that point, we decided, you know what? And not only that, but then, see, Washington is just, it's beautiful. And that's
the
attraction
here. Don't tell anybody that, though.
Okay,
I won't tell anyone. It's like people don't know that we have gorgeous weather starting like now.
Starting now. It's just so beautiful. As a matter of fact, our
cell phone numbers have changed to 206. I'm sad to be leaving.
You're like fully adopting us.
I love that. Washington driver's license.
When people do that.
I'm 206 now.
Yeah.
I got rid of the Texas cell phone number, and I'm sad to be leaving downtown. We're leaving because we're used to bigger homes. We're used to more affordable priced homes, and we found it in Normandy Park. So,
yeah.
But just because we're leaving, we've got four people that are trying to move into Capitol Hill.
That's pretty bougie, Colleen would say.
Normandy Park? I don't know much about Normandy Park.
Do you think it's bougie?
Do you have a view?
Hey, she's allowed to be bougie if she wants to be bougie. Yeah, she can have any life she wants.
If we didn't have the building next to us, we would have a view, but we don't. But we have beautiful tree views, which I'm quite content with.
Feels private. Nice.
Yeah. So I say move into downtown. And let's get Seattle thriving again.
Very convenient for the airport for trips back to Texas.
Well, yes, absolutely. My wife will be traveling a lot next year for work. So yes, it'll be fantastic.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.